Welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast, where we explore the intersection of creativity and student learning. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher and current college professor. I'm the co-author of Launch, Using Design Thinking to Boost Creativity and Bring Out the Maker in Every Student. I'm passionate about seeing schools become bastions of creativity and wonder. And to me, that's what it's all about when we think of the future of learning, which is our latest podcast series. So on the last one, we really focused on this question of, you know, what were the big tech trends that would be impacting your classroom in the next 5 years? And now we're going to focus a little more on one specific skill that's vital in the 21st century, and that's content curation. So here's getting started with content curation. So the term curate has become a buzzword in education. I've seen it referred to in TED Talks and tossed around in Twitter chats, and it's easy to write off buzzwords as trendy, but what if an idea is trending for a reason? We live in a world of instant information, where ideas go viral without much thought regarding accuracy or validity. It's a place where content is cheap. It's cheaper to make, it's cheaper to share, it's cheaper to consume. And the traditional gatekeepers are gone, which is a good thing for most students. They can now create and share their work in ways that were previously unimaginable. But there's a cost. The best stuff doesn't always rise to the top. And if you're not careful, we mistake the speed of consumption for the depth of knowledge. It becomes a rat race where whoever learns the fastest wins. And that's not necessarily what it means to be educated. So I want to talk to you about this rise of the curators. In recent years, we've seen the rise in popularity of a group of bloggers that specialize in content curation. In a world of information saturation, curation has become a critical, vital skill. And curation goes beyond simply collecting items online. That's often what we think of, people who collect things and share it. But the best curators know how to find what is best by immersing themselves in a niche area while they are also making surprising connections between the ideas in seemingly unrelated world. Curators find specific excerpts, like bits and pieces, and they, you know, analyze them and make sense out of them. And they then share it in a way that's vital for the moment and necessary for now, but it's also timeless and evergreen. They can explain the purpose, the context, the necessity of what they are citing. But it's not just that they're citing it, that they're actually displaying the work of others in a powerful way. Often a great curator adds a perspective and a lens without quite reaching the place of commentary. Their job is not to tell you what to read necessarily. Their job is not even to tell you what to believe or think about what you're seeing. A curator instead focuses more on displaying it and sharing it and explaining it. And that can be refreshing in a world that is obsessed with sharing opinions. It's a chance to simply say, hey, check this out. It's really, really awesome. And often curators will seem simple. A great curation blog on the surface seems like, oh, it's just someone showing you what they read or showing you what they watched or showing you what they're into. But what you miss at first, you later on understand over time, and it's that the curators have produced this altogether different layer of content because of their curation. They've added a lens, a perspective, they've organized it differently, and they've explained it with just enough verbiage that it comes alive and becomes accessible. And that is something different. That goes beyond simply sharing a link or posting a pin. It's true curation at its best. Now, there's certain curation blogs that I love, and I'll just list them right now. Farnham Street. I love Farnham Street, and Shane Farnham, he has this description on his blog where he says, I want to go to bed each night smarter than when I woke up. I also want to live a meaningful life and become a better person. And so that's what he shares. It's all about that. Maria Popova is amazing in Brain Pickings. And she has this lens that she adds about what it means to do creative work that I think anyone who's engaging in any kind of making should check out. And she'll find things that other people wrote or videos that other people have made or pictures, but she displays them in a way that feels fresh and accessible and smart without being pretentious. And that's really hard to do. Another one is Fast Company. I know that they're technically a magazine full of articles, but they do a wonderful job curating a diverse range of topics within the zone of creativity. And that's something that I love about the Fast Company blog. Now, one that's a little more of an actual curation site is Open Culture. I love the way they find seemingly random items from our culture that are free and they share them. And then another one is Mental Floss. Like Fast Company, Mental Floss is actually a magazine, but they often curate information in a way that makes it deliberately popular. They use catchy titles and listicles in an approach that's the complete opposite of what you see with Brain Pickings. But this sense of being approachable, of making it something anyone can access, is something that all of these have in common. Now, some of those curation blogs are purely curation blogs, and some of them get into the area of creative, original content on their own. And most of them have a blend of the two. But that's what you see. You see this rise of the curators. So what exactly is content curation? I'm going to take us on a step backwards for a second. I'm drawn toward the archaic definition of this term curation. It originally had a much more earthy, even gritty connotation. Some linguists tie it back to the medieval Latin word curare, which meant to cure an illness. It had a connotation of providing loving attention and management. The word curator goes back to the word curatus, which means spiritual guide or one responsible for the tending of souls. And I think that that's something that we don't necessarily think of as being a 21st century skill. That actually sounds really, really archaic, but bear with me. Because that piece of loving attention and management, that sense of curing the soul, I think is at the heart of what content curation is actually all about. So back to the definition. Over time, the word morphed into an intense care and love of a particular subject, knowledge, or set of artistic works. A curator is one who collects and manages information with a passion and a love for the subject, which is a wonderful endeavor. But I've noticed that the best of the curators are able to tap into that original sense of being one responsible for the care of souls. And as teachers, that's what we do. We help students grow in wisdom. We are curators. That's a part of our job. But that's also what we want for our students. We want them to be passionate and excited, but also have this nuanced care for what they're learning. We want them to pay attention to the context and purpose of the information that they consume. We want them to make connections and provide their own lens to what they're seeing. And that is content curation. And again, that's vital because in a world consumed with instant gratification and free media and amusement, there's something deliberate and nuanced and even archaic about curation that I think students really, really need. So what does content curation typically look like? Content curation begins with an intense love of the content. Think of gallery curators. They get giddy over seemingly random yet almost impossible to replicate approach of something like a Jackson Pollock painting. But they can also engage in a two-hour discussion on the relationship between kitsch art and postmodern philosophy. And that's what content curators do. They are geeky about it, but they are also sages at the same time. Curators have a holistic, connected knowledge combined with thoughtful commentary. While there is an overlap with criticism sometimes, curators are more likely to geek out on a subject in a way that is explanatory rather than evaluative. This is often combined with a desire to make work accessible to the public. So while they are the gatekeepers, critics are the ones who are shutting the gates, while curators are the ones who are opening the gates and begging people to get inside. That's what a curator does. If all that seems too abstract, here are a few things that you could think of with the curation process. It starts with searching for the content. The best curators are the ones who can find content that not everyone notices. So they're looking deeper into the web. They're looking deeper into the books. They're going to the library, things like that. They are really searching out the content that doesn't naturally rise to the top. Next, they're geeking out on the content. The best curators are able to collect and consume great content. It's not a mindless consumption. It is mindful and relaxed, but also sharp and analytical. And that's important. One of the things I've noticed about the best curators is that they can scribble notes all over the margins of books, and yet they feel the complete freedom to skip and skim whenever they seem necessary. They know how to find what's important. Organizing content. Curation often involves placing content into categories or themes. Often students will try to figure out the right way to organize the information because schools typically teach students an external organizational system. However, this is important for students to learn, the sense of classifying information, and it is deeply personal, and it should mirror the way students think. Next, you can think about making connections. They're always finding connections between seemingly unrelated disciplines, and it makes you constantly say, man, I never even considered that. Another thing they do is they find trends. This aspect of curation is a little more analytical. Sometimes it even involves picking apart data or crunching numbers. It's the idea of looking at information across several spaces and finding specific trends. This is often where someone arrives at a different, counterintuitive conclusion. Adding a unique lens. That's when they give something that's distinctly theirs. There's typically a clarity and a brevity to the commentary that they're adding. When it's well done, a curator almost seems invisible, moving along the snippets of content and sharing it with you. And yet, over time, you begin to appreciate this subtle personality and the voice of a curator. I like to think of a curator as somebody who is almost whispering. They're not shouting out their opinion like a critic or even a commentator, but they're gently whispering you along from place to place in the content. And finally, you can think about sharing the content. Content curation has the end goal of getting great content out to people. It is deliberately other-centered, even when the curator is introspective and introverted. Sometimes the goal is to provide a set of practical information into the hands of readers, and other times it's more about offering something intriguing and fascinating, even if it's not inherently practical. So a curator in engineering, for example, might be different than a curator in art, and that's okay, because they're both doing something very valuable in terms of curation. So here are 5 ways to get started with content curation. All right, let's make it practical for a second. Number 1, model content curation. Notice that few students walk into class knowing how to curate. We live in a consumer culture and it values speed and amusement over the slower, deliberate thought that is needed in curation. Kind of see the curation process, not simply as a physical process that you go through, but as a thinking process. They need to model the mindset of a curator. Number 2, let students geek out. Curators are natural geeks. They get excited about ideas and topics within their domain. They engage in research in a way that feels like an adventure. So if we want students to engage in content curation, we need to let them geek out. tap into their prior knowledge and let them run with it. Number three, spend more time on it. Content curation takes time. That's just a reality. And we have to carve out that time in our classroom if we want to see it actually happen. There's no way around it. That's just, that's simply the way to do it. And that's it. I mean, there's no shortcuts. This is the part where I would love to say, like, spend less time testing, or spend more time on this, or spend more time on that, or do less packets. But there really is no solution for it. You have to spend time in class curating if you want to see it actually work. The cool thing is, once kids become curators in the classroom, it transfers outside of the classroom, and they become natural curators outside the classroom. And that is when it becomes pretty exciting. Number four, begin earlier. So one of the things I was thinking about is how in a lot of classrooms, people do research at the very end of the year. It's this end of the year culminating project, and it's a big research project. But my thought is, begin at the beginning of the year and integrate it, this curation process, into things like silent reading and into research and into blogging and into a lot of these different things at the beginning of the year, so that over time they can become true master curators. Number five, let students own the process. And I got into that a lot in the previous podcast, but this is the idea that they should choose the topics, the questions, the sources. They should be writing it themselves. They should choose what kind of platform they want to curate on. If it's Pinterest or a blog or a podcast or a video series, they should own this curation process. Even if you've modeled it for them, again, you're not modeling the right way to curate. You're modeling the way to think like a curator. And that's the thing. You are a curator. People often say things like, the teacher is no longer the source of information now that students can curate it themselves. This is typically accompanied by the term guide on the side to describe a student's role. But here's the thing. While I see some validity in this sentiment that kids are just already great curators, I think it proves that now more than ever, teachers need to be curators. They need to be the ones showing students how to curate. They need to be geeking out on their subjects. They need to help students figure out where to go. Yes, they might be on the side, but they are still guides, helping students navigate the terrain for the first time ever. And that's precisely what a curator does. We curate so that we can help students learn the art of content curation. See, teachers are already curators. We piece together resources, research, and ideas that they develop as lessons. And that in itself is curation. We curate the content that we teach. We figure out great books and videos and podcasts that we love, and we curate it. This isn't anything new or groundbreaking. This is what happens when we find a great book or video and share it with our students. It's what happens when we share our favorite sites with our colleagues. And that's content curation. That's what we are already engaging in. But what if we take this art of curation to the next level? And we teach it to our students. What if we make it a priority to let them become true master content curators? How would it change school? How would it change the way we learn? How would it prepare them for the future? My guess is, in a world that is bombarded by constant content being swept away by the latest amusements, and being distracted so easily without necessarily thinking deeply, it would seem that content curation as a mindset and a skill is perhaps one of the most valuable things that students need in the future of learning. Hey, thank you for listening to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm John Spencer. Hope you have a great day. Quick favor to ask: if you enjoy this podcast, would you leave a kind review on iTunes? That lets people find this podcast easier, and it's just a great way to tell me, hey, I enjoy it, because it kind of feels like I'm just talking to myself sometimes when I'm doing this podcast. The music is from Ben Sounds. I love that. that website. They have free Creative Commons music. I am not a sponsor or anything, I promise. They're not sponsoring this show. I just love the background music that they produce for videos and presentations, things like that. So hope this gave you something to think about, and I hope you have a wonderful day.